88.3 Southern FM.
And coming up right now is the Space Show. Now, welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and here's a little surprise for you.
If I could turn back time, if I could find a way, baby. If I could turn back time.
Well, on this evening's The Space Show, sure, cannot turn back time, but applied science enables radio to do so. First, we wind back time to back 50 years to the Skylab 4 mission. Well, now, on last week's The Space Show, we turned back time and we began to tell the tale of the so-called strike by the astronauts of the Skylab 4 50 years ago. Well, Skylab 2 astronaut Joe Kuhn told us that the story was rubbish, and he criticised the book written by Henry Cooper. Well, not everything written by Cooper in his book A House in Space was incorrect. For example, this quote from page 87 of Cooper's book. During a very busy period during the Skylab 4 mission, astronaut William Pogue said, and I quote, "There's not enough consideration given for moving from one point in the spacecraft to another and allowing for transition from one experiment to another. Now, I don't like being put in an incredible position where I'm taking somebody's expensive equipment and threshing about wildly with it and trying to act like a one-armed paper hanger trying to get it started in insufficient time." Well, that workload comment on the Skylab 4 mission was later the subject of a humorous exchange between the astronauts and mission control.
And you guys have been awarded a prestigious award, and if you can listen here for a second, I'd like to advise you on it.
Go ahead, Dick.
Okay. First of all, I'd like to say that the reason you have been awarded this is because this last set of execute shifts that the Purple Gang has worked with you, have every day has gone so great, we're going to be off for a couple of days. It reads as follows: the Fraternal Order of One-Armed Paper Hangers, in recognition of your efforts on SL-4, and particularly of the last week, have elected you collectively One-Armed Paper Hangers of the Year. And the I'd like to describe the award to you. It's a large picture of a guy who's hanging paper on the side of the MDA. One foot is working the ATM. He's doing a couple of corollaries with the other foot, and he's saying to himself, "Let's see, do I give up sleeping and eating to get this stuff done? Or do I tell the Purple Flight to shove it? Purple Flight is pretty big. I wonder if I can outrun him. Oh, well, I'm tired of the high-density food anyway, and these sleep restraints sure ain't feather beds, so I guess I'll go ahead and work. And it'll be sitting on your desk when you get home."
"Treat me like it. We'll look forward to producing. We're all deeply moved, Dick."
"Roger. It really has been a good set of days, though, and we'll see you when we get back."
"Thank you, Dick. Thanks for all your help. So long. Have a good time off."
To continue the Skylab 4 story, between 1970 and 1972, approximately 2.4 million hectares of trees were damaged by gypsy moths in the United States. Oak trees are particularly susceptible to damage. Now, during 1972 and 1973, it was hoped that weightlessness might induce some intracellular redistribution of material within the moth embryo to speed up the maturation of laboratory-bred male moths. To that end, gypsy moth eggs were carried on Skylab 4. About 500 eggs were flown, but only 7 hatched. The crew, who were checking the vials of eggs daily, excitedly reported the hatching.
"Houston, we have an announcement."
"Go ahead."
"We are pleased to announce the birth of our first moth. The attending physician, Carr, Gibson, and Pogue, Describe the status of the babies as alive, moving, but somewhat hairy. Their weights are zero, and their masses are very small. The first one was born on day 348, sometime in the middle of the afternoon. The physicians were caught off guard and didn't have boiled water or newspapers on hand. At this time, there are five babies crawling over their potential brothers. The cover is not being removed since they are all of a wild breed. The physicians have delivered successfully several times, but not being suitably adapted to moth mothering, are ill-prepared to feed the little fellows. Houston, request advice.
Hey, Bob is looking for an answer now. Ed, I'm not sure how I'm going to break this to you, but we really don't have any plans to feed them.
Don't we even have any old spider food left over?
At this point, we're not sure whether you owe us cigars or we owe you cigars.
The experiment result was regarded as inconclusive as a way to use sterile male moths to control or eliminate the gypsy moth population. The 84-day duration Skylab 4 had been launched in November of 1973 and so were in orbit on Christmas Day. Rather than take the day off and wear Santa hats, two of the crewmen donned spacesuits and conducted an extravehicular activity. That's what most people incorrectly call a spacewalk. During their excursions, they passed over Tasmania and New Zealand.
Skylab, this is Houston, through the Vanguard on station off the coast of Argentina this morning. Support your EVA. Wishing you all a very Merry Christmas for real this time, since although we've been wishing you a Merry Christmas for a couple of days, today is the day. Over.
Morning, Bruce. Merry Christmas to you. Story, we just crossed in the southeast coast of Australia. Tasmania down there, I think. New Zealand can't be far away.
Right. What's new in New Zealand?
I got to turn around here and rubberneck for a little bit.
Yeah, it's a great time for it.
Don't get to do this often enough.
Holy cow, what a view.
Skylab, we understood you started SO20 again, and until we get regrouped here on your APCS, I would like you to proceed on with the sun end film replacement.
Okay, we'll do it. Bill, you suppose New Zealand's under those clouds right there?
I've lost my sense of direction right along in here.
Well, no, we're still too close to Australia. It's right up
yeah,
there.
Yeah, it should be ahead of us a little bit. It does look like there's an awful lot of clouds covering up there, though.
Yeah. Oh, I see it. There it is.
Yeah, I got it.
Hello, New Zealand. Beautiful country.
Late in 1973, a prominent comet named after astronomer Lubos Kohoutek appeared in our skies. Now, Kohoutek discovered this comet in 1973, March. The Skylab 4 crew were asked to observe the comet both before and after perihelion, its closest approach to the sun. Now, this pass at 0.142 astronomical units occurred on December the 28th.
And, Bill, I'm up here in the command module, and I got a real good view of the comet in the binoculars now.
Okay, we got that.
I get a very prominent tail.
Roger, Bruce. It's a CDR. I got a look at Kohoutek.
Okay, we're right here, and we'd like to hear your comments.
Okay, I got a good look. My first good look at Kohoutek in several days on window number 3 while we were in the attitude for SO63. I mentioned last night that I had a vague impression of being able to see the curved part of the tail as well as the straight. I was not able to get that feeling as I was looking at it a few minutes ago. The tail, however, is quite long. It's longer than I've seen out the command module window, and that reinforces my conviction that we were not seeing all of the comet out the command module window, that part of it was being occulted by the ATM solar panel. The tail is getting quite visible now and is indeed quite long. I wouldn't even know how to go about giving you an estimate of how many degrees I would say it is, but it's getting easier and easier to see.
Okay, how about if you hold your hand out at arm's length and compare the width of the comet with the apparent width of your hand or finger?
Man, I can't see out the window.
How about a finger?
It's down in a corner.
On the day of perihelion, the crew discussed the comet with Lubos Kohoutek, who was visiting Mission Control.
Standing in for the other Kohoutek PIs, we have Dr. Lubos Kohoutek, the discoverer of the comet, and he'd like to ask you a few questions when you're ready. Over.
Roger, Houston, we're ready to go. Good afternoon, Dr. Kohoutek.
Good afternoon. I am very glad to have an opportunity to following the comet 1973F during its most critical day, during its perihelion passage. And from the place where most research of that comet is concentrated. Especially, it is a great pleasure for me to greet you, Mr. Gibson, Mr. Kerr, and Mr. Polk, as the first human beings studying a comet from outer space. Your mission is indeed very important for astronomy. I have the following questions. You observed the comet visually last Sunday and Monday. You compared it with in brightness with Mercury and suggested that there were color features in the coma. Do you have anything more to say on those observations?
Not too much to add to that, sir, because we have not seen much of the comet visually since those last observations. The one time in which I was the one who observed the color, I have not seen the comet since. The next time I saw the comet was on the SO52 white light coronagraph.
Oh, yes. And how about the tail, for example?
The tail we have found, as it becomes more foreshortened to us, became much whiter. And let me give you figures that are relative to the display we have on the ATM. I would say that the coma, the bright coma, was approximately 3/16, 1/8 to 3/16 of an inch in diameter. And I would say that the tail that we could see, however foreshortened, extended only about 1/4 inch away from the coma and spread like a fan to approximately 3/8 of an inch at its outermost end.
Have you glimpsed the comet since Monday, I mean visually?
No, sir, we have not.
How is the brightness changing from day to day? You are the only people who see this comet at present, and therefore your information is very valuable.
Well, unfortunately, we are not able to see it by eye. We can only tell by what we see on the white light coronagraph display. That display has indicated that the brightness certainly is increasing. The display itself has a filtering function, which allows you to see the corona much better, so that it's a factor of 100 from the edge of the occulting disk all the way out to the edge of the display. So we were only able to see it at the very beginning, very close to the edge of the display. Now we can see it pretty much right up next to the, fairly close to the occulting disk, so I'm sure we're at least up a factor of 10 from that when we first saw it, and perhaps greater than that.
Yes, thank you very much for a most interesting talk. Let me congratulate you upon the accomplishment you have achieved so far and wish you the best of success in your further observations and flawless splashdown in February. Thank you very much.
Dr. Kohoutek, on behalf of the Skylab 3 crew, I'd like to tell you that we're honored to have this opportunity to speak to you, sir. And we'll do our best to get the best data we possibly can. Good day, sir.
During a later extravehicular activity, the Skylab 4 astronauts were able to observe Comet Kohoutek again.
Hey, I can see the comet. Yeah, look it, right out there. See it? Okay, I can see the tail behind.
Holy cow, yeah.
Hey, turn the lights off, Bill.
Oh, yeah, beautiful.
You sure can.
Skylab, we're enjoying your comments. We're 30 seconds from LOS here, about 28 minutes to Carnarvon at 1803. All your systems are good.
Okay, we can see the tail, which is anti-solar, but I cannot see the spike, which showed up yesterday on the photography.
Okay, it's just going into the airflow now.
Just going into the airflow.
Very wide, broad tail. Not very long, as well as we can see.
Well, we were not too well dark adapted there, Jer. We'll have to make a note of that next time.
Yeah.
Okay, that tail, I guess, I was looking at 5 degrees or so. when I first spotted it. Okay, it's into the air glow now. I suspect that's the reason you couldn't see it the other day, is because it was always in the air glow.
Yeah.
We got a better elongation now. I suspect you ought to see that out the window. I looked at that looked for it yesterday out window 3 and couldn't see it.
And just after Christmas of 1973, the three Skylab 4 astronauts were halfway through their 84-day mission.
The morning at 8:35 Central Standard Time, the crew will reach the halfway point in the scheduled 84-day mission. The space station will be over the South Atlantic Ocean at this time at 8:35 Central Standard Time. At that point, the space station, the crew will have made 607 trips around the Earth, logging 17,650,000 miles in space since their launch from Cape Kennedy on November 16th. The space station, however, will have logged 3,292 revolutions of the Earth, or 95,760,000 miles since launch from Cape Kennedy on May 14th.
The occasion was marked by a press conference in which reporters could ask questions mediated by an astronaut in Houston's mission control.
As you're undoubtedly aware, this is the first Skylab 4 live news conference. I have a list of questions here which have been prepared by the news representatives to the Johnson Space Center working through their news media pool. I'll be reading them off to you verbatim and in the order that's requested by the newsman. Over.
Okay, we're ready to go.
Okay, first question for you, Jerry. You are past the halfway point now. What have been the flight's main accomplishments, and do you feel you'll go the full 84 days? Over.
The flight's main accomplishments, I think, have been the accomplishment of the EVAs. I think one of the prime accomplishments was to get the S-193 running. We're real happy we got that going, and that certainly does enhance the Earth resources situation. We've got a second load of film in for the ATM work, and we have our outside Kahootek observations done right close to perihelion. I think those are really some of the main milestones that we had to look forward to.
What does the crew hope to accomplish in the second half of the mission? Over.
Second half of the mission, what we hope to accomplish. We want to continue the observations, of course, with the Apollo telescope mount. We will be shortly resuming the intensified observations with our Earth resources instrument. And we also have a large number of corollary experiments and educational experiments or student experiments, which we hope to complete. I think that some of the major maintenance activities are out of the way. We shortly will be concluding the most intensified portion of the cometary observations, and that will be behind us. We'll be concentrating on the Apollo telescope mount and the Earth resources.
Okay. For Ed, while staring out the window, you've remarked about visualizing life on other worlds. Please elaborate. And have your feelings been heightened by this flight? Over.
Okay, Bruce. To the folks who came up with this question, actually this is one, I guess, which would make a lot of people raise their eyebrows. And what I said at the time was that it makes you speculate perhaps a little bit more in your own mind, because you're much more conscious of the many different star systems that there are out there. When you're looking out here, you see the Earth as one unit, you see the Sun as a star, and you see all the other stars out there, and you realize that the universe is quite big, and just the number of possible combinations that you could have out there which would create life, all of a sudden enters your mind and makes it seem very much more likely. I don't think that that is any different than people have thought down on the ground. It's just that being up here and being able to see the stars as you can, and look back at the Earth and see your own sun as a star, makes you much more conscious of that.
All right, thank you, Ed. Back to Jerry. You said you're keeping notes on your impressions of the Earth. What are some of these impressions? Over.
Well, I think the most startling impression to me, I always thought of the Earth as a very green and verdant planet. And when you're going over some of the desolate areas we've seen, I suddenly have gotten a very strong impression, as I mentioned in the Christmas message, is that
I've become aware of all the desolate areas there are around the Earth, and it's become apparent to me that man is kind of huddled in just a few corners of the Earth, that the Earth is really a whole lot bigger than we thought. And I tried in my Christmas message there to kind of compare our impressions, or my impressions anyway, with those impressions of the Apollo crews, who said the Earth is very small. And the fact that man has to stay in the temperate areas and really work in his environment kind of makes me feel that we're going to have to spur on our efforts to really get in tune with our environment.
Roger on that. Back to Ed. Some earlier Skylab crewmen have reported brief periods of irritation with one another. Has there been any sign of this on your flight, over?
No, I don't think so, Bruce. I think all three of us have been pretty much up against the same things, and we're cooperating and trying to get the best out of the mission and meeting those various obstacles that we've come up against. So I think we've hung together pretty well, and I think we're all pretty proud of that fact.
Roger, we've got about 52 seconds to LOS here. Let me throw one more out as we go over the hill to you, for all three of you. Aside from your families, what do you miss most about being away from the Earth, over?
I think good food and ability to eat anytime you want to. I miss that more than anything.
I think what I miss is going right back to Jerry's point, the ability to recoup at the end of the day and to be able to analyze where you're going the next day and to be able to take a really a fresh, creative approach in the things you're doing. I think essentially that's what I miss the most, too. I miss the opportunity to just sit down and relax. And, of course, with my family at home, I can come home and just take it easy and be with them. I miss football, and I miss a good cold can of beer while I'm watching the game.
Well, that was the, or those were the three Skylab 4 astronauts answering questions put by the press but relayed to them by astronaut Bruce McCandless. Well, Skylab has been mentioned in many popular songs. Most of them are about the fall of the space station in 1979 in Western Australia. For example, here is Gary Stoll's Down Fell Skylab. I think you will recognize the tune.
All right, I can do it. I'll do it for them. There's an explanation. Okay.
Once a jolly swag man camped beside a billabong under the spreading clover bell tree, and he sang as he saw the blazing lights up in the sky. Oh, my dear God, did it have to be me? Down fell the Skylab, down fell the Skylab, down it did fall on his cuckoo bill tree, and he sang as he saw the blazing lights up in the sky. Oh, my dear God, did it have to be me? Home came a piece to rest beside the billabong. Up jumped the swagman and grabbed it with glee, and he screamed as he threw that piece into the billabong. Oh, my dear God, it is too hot for me. Down fell the Skylab, down fell the Skylab, down it did fall on his cuckoo-bill tree, and he screamed as he threw that piece into the billabong. Oh, my dear God, it is too hot for me. Down came the scavenger riding in his four-wheel drive, down to the billabong, and what he did scream. He screamed as he saw the piece in the billabong. It is worth thousands to you and to me. Down came the Skylab, down came the Skylab, and down it did fall on his cuckoo-bill tree. He screamed as he saw the piece into the billabong. It is worth thousands to you and to me. Up jumped the swag man, leapt into the billabong. I'll get it back, you just wait and see. His ghost can be heard, she walked beside the billabong. Oh, my dear God, did it have to be me? Down fell the Skylab, down fell the Skylab, and down it did fall on his cuckoo-bill tree. Same as he walked down beside the billabong. Oh, my dear God, did it have to be me?
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.